This session was recorded at Journey Underground, a recovery ministry of Journey Christian Church in Fairbanks, Alaska.
All right, welcome to the Underground. Happy Easter, everybody. That's really cool. Well, I got to share my testimony a little bit this morning at Journey. It's always tough to do about how I came to this town and I was Poe. You know, you say, no, you were poor. No, I couldn't afford the O and the R. I was Poe. That's Poe. All right. About 2.5 years ago, my wife and I received a phone call from a young lady who was going through a really hard time. She had been in the middle of some severe domestic violence, sexual abuse, and drug addiction, crack cocaine, and amongst others. And she'd been on about a 3-year heroin run, and she was on her way to Fairbanks. And we were going to be on the other end of that, receiving a Delta Christian Church, in fact, paid for her ticket out here, come to us. Thank you for that. So this lady shows up. You know, when you're on a 3-year heroin run, you're not just doing heroin to get high. At that point, you're running from the withdrawals. You know, you're running from something at that point. You're not running to anything. This was the nightmare that this lady was in. There's so much when it comes to domestic violence and the kind of relationships where that dynamic's happening. There's a lot going on within a person that needs healing. To mix that with the drug addiction and all those other things, you know, we knew we had our hands full. I just want you to know that lady has made a remarkable recovery. She has walked out a miracle, and we have watched God do amazing things in this person's life and through this person, and I got to watch it with my own eyes. So I'm going to ask that lady to go ahead and come on up here. Come on up here, Deb. Give her a hand, guys. Yeah! Come on up here. All right. Well, thank you for letting me do this interview. I got to say, people who are involved in recovery world, we do not get the opportunity to interview many people like this because there aren't many people like this. And it is a tough, tough thing to walk out one of those things, let alone all of those things. You are definitely one of my heroes. So let me ask you this. And you answer this how you want to. What is the first thing that you really needed to know that would give you the courage to take a step, cut your losses, and take that leap? What was it that your heart needed to know for you to have that kind of courage to do it?
Okay, so you're used to hearing me say this a lot, but grace. When I came to know God early in my life, actually, 16, I knew that Jesus died for my sins and that I was saved. But then after I got saved, I thought I had to earn my keep. that was a very fragile thing. In my mind, that's just what I had said in my mind. And I can remember going through the fruit of the Spirit. This was kind of a big deal. I would go through the fruit of the Spirit in my young Christian walk, and I would look at all these different fruits, and I'm like, this is overwhelming. Mm-hmm. So I'll just pick one fruit a day. Because then I'll be able to, you know, keep it in good with God. And I says, okay, by all the strength I've got in me, I'm going to go for kindness today. Mm-hmm. And as soon as I would pick something out and in my own strength, mm-hmm. I was going to muster up kindness that day. I was horrible. Mm-hmm. I sucked. Can I say that? It was horrible. It's like I became this mean monster all that day. And then, of course, patience is on the list. Holy smokes. That was horrible. So, and I would go through this. I mean, I didn't just go through it once. I continued to keep going through this. I'm like, I have got to do this. And I would beat myself up because I had this, in my mind, this measurement of perfection that had to be had to be acceptable, not just to myself, to God, but to everyone that mattered to me. you would think it would create a really cool person that would try to do their best in everything. Mm-hmm. It just made me worse and worse and worse and really bad. So to come to a verse like John chapter 1, 17, where it says the law came by Moses, but truth and grace came by Jesus Christ. That verse is a breath of fresh air to me. Because under the law, there was naturally condemnation for me, judgment from myself. And I could feel it from everyone. I just knew it was there. And from God. And so in that judgment, I had to do a couple things. But my thing was denial. Well, I'm okay. Everything's okay. It's fine. I'm not having any problems at all. And in that denial became the make-believe, and denial, make-believe, judgment, condemnation. And when I got to the truth and grace side through Jesus Christ, when that finally started coming to me, and this is just like weeks before mm-hmm. I came up here,
right.
When I started to see what grace was about and that I was supposed to rest in who God says I am, rest didn't even compute to me, because we had to work for what we had. But to rest in God, I can remember hearing a sermon while I was so messed up. I mean, I was so messed up. I can remember hearing the sermon and this man preaching on the TV, and he kept talking about God's grace, God's grace. I'm like, whatever. And he said, let me challenge any addict out there that may be listening. Let me challenge you that before you do whatever you do in your addiction, to claim the truth. And the truth is this: in Jesus Christ, he's made you righteous. And so I'm thinking, okay, he says I'm righteous. That sounds like denial to me, but whatever, make believe. But he says, claim the righteousness of Christ. I am the righteousness of Christ before you do whatever addiction it is that you do. And I remember when I first heard that, I thought, there is no way that I will be able to withstand the horror of who I am to say that right before I would do any drug, before I would shoot drugs into my veins or to smoke crack. I mean, who does that? And I can remember when I had the courage to do that, strange things started to happen. The drug didn't mean anything. It wasn't rescuing me from anything. I started to have clarity. I started to see the truth. And in that truth, there's freedom. I mean, the scriptures say, you know, by the truth, you shall be set free. And I was being set free within weeks. It was just weeks before I called and said, man, Stan, I need help. This is horrible. So, truth and grace. Sorry to make that answer
truth
so long.
Truth and grace.
Truth and grace, man. I needed it.
She's obviously done a lot of study, and by the language, you know, that you're using, that's some powerful stuff. For me, I know one of the most painful things was for me to look into a mirror and see my own face because of the things I had done and the people I had hurt, and to see all those things, loathing the person looking back. And I remember just a few, I think weeks, months ago, my wife had moved a mirror in our house, and I didn't know about it, and I go walking by, and there's, you know, you see it, and you're like, you know, and I thought it, what she's talking about. I saw a glimpse, and I was like, oh, did I see? Oh, I did see, you know, there he is. You know, I looked, see myself, and I thought the thought, and you probably know what I'm going to say, but I thought the thought. I thought, well, there he is. There's that guy. And I look back, and sure enough, there I am. And I'm like, there you are. There's a guy. Now there's a guy that God loves. There's a guy that God loves. He's really crazy about that guy right there. Boy, there's a guy right there that God would do anything for.
Oh.
And that God has kept every promise. All he said that he could do with me and what he would do in me if I would trust him, he's kept that promise, and he's turned the darkest parts of my heart of shame and brokenness, and he's done it. He's actually done it. He has done what he said he would do if I would trust him, that I am someone he loves. So that is the beginning of all of our healing, is he loves me. and then begin operating out of that, not trying to operate for something. And that is a very profound thing. There's a cart and there's a horse is what we're saying, and we have to get right, right?
Mm-hmm.
And so, okay, second question here. The reason we all use a plate to eat off of is because we need a platform. We need something to work off of, right?
Amen.
Get the bacon and eggs down or whatever, unless you're too po. Then it's ramen noodles or whatever it is. So we all need a plate. We need a platform so we can receive nutrients. And so one of the hardest things that we have found people to find in recovery is to get that support. Support that you're not just comfortable with, because if we get only the support we're comfortable with, we're probably going to be surrounded by people that are going to bring us right down, right? So we have to have a mixture of people that we're not always comfortable with. They're going to tell us things we don't always want to hear. But we need a mixture of people, people that understand where we're coming from, know our stories. One of the hardest things to do is to build that support team around you that are going to help you launch. And
yes.
It's not about them. It's not about being their project, about making a program look good or any of that kind of stuff. You know, it's about them really investing in you to help you launch, and they hold you accountable to be awesome because they see it in you. How on earth, Debbie, did you put that platform together? How did you do that? How did that happen for you?
Well, number one, I couldn't put it together.
Okay.
I had thoroughly messed up my life. First, getting clean, that was a pretty big deal. But as it cleared, as my mind cleared, God started putting amazing things together for me. When I showed up on Alaska's doorstep, okay, the mess that I was, I showed up, like you said, with multiple issues. Complex post-traumatic stress disorder, that's a pretty big deal. Battered wife syndrome, totally had that too. I was a cutter. I was a suicide attempter, just attempted a few days before I came up here, and drug addiction. So I had a lot of things going, and to find one sponsor would be a joke.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
It would be an absolute joke, because there's not one person that could. Could you imagine trying to be there for that kind of person?
Right.
I'd suck you dry. So I needed a network of people, genuine people. It couldn't be where I felt like I was a project. It needed to be genuine, and at first available at a lot of odd hours. Thank you, Stan, for that.
I looked for Asian then because I was tired. The Asian comes out when I'm sleepy.
But showing up to as many things as I could was a key thing. Taking notes, because there was no way I was going to remember the things that were being said to me, because a lot of it was new. A lot of it was concepts that were beyond me. So I needed to take a lot of notes. And when people would say, you know, when I read this book, it really helped me. I'm like, what book was it? Who wrote that book? And I can remember one of the books that made a huge difference in my recovery was The Beautiful Outlaw by John Eldridge. Life-changing for me. Ended up, well, you probably remember, I was going through books like every day.
Yeah.
Just taking in as much truth as I could, as you know, as deep as I could. But having a network of people, getting professional care, because post-traumatic stress is no joke. And I needed some professional help to get through a lot of that. And I'm still going. And just a lot of support from different areas. Small groups, huge.
Yeah. Oops.
A huge deal. A safe place to go on a regular basis. Huge deal. I needed to feel that I could be honest and vulnerable in a safe, sacred place. Very, very important. So with all that, God is doing his mighty work.
That's really, really cool. And if there's a question I missed where you guys are like, you know, ask this question, ask this, then, you know, raise your hand up and ask the question. We want to hear these answers. Okay, so obstacles, you know, give me, you know, I'll tell you, coming off of any chemical that you've been using for a long period of time, or coming off of a relationship that you've been leaning on for a long period of time, we're talking about some serious obstacles that a person faces. What are some of the big obstacles you face that really threatened your sobriety? I mean, I remember a time when I'm like, where is she? She's gone. She's not in the house. You know, this is Alaska. We live out, you know, North Pole, right by the flood control. And where is she? And I rode all the way out to the flood control, and there she's standing out in the middle of this giant field in the middle of nowhere. And she was just weeping and weeping and weeping. And I'm like, a beautiful girl standing out in the middle of nowhere in Alaska is not a real good idea, you know. But she was in a lot of pain, and she was in a lot of internal, like, agony, and had conflict, and she had very limited choices, and I was afraid for her, what she would do. Because you put some of us in the wrong situation where we feel too squeezed, you know, we're going to get real slippery. And we see that all the time. What are some of the big obstacles that really just about took you off the tracks there?
My natural inability to slow down. That was a huge obstacle for me.
Good one.
Yeah, slowing down is like, right. Horrible inability to slow down. And because I had been in such an abusive relationship for 10 years, there was a lot of panic with this horrible guilt that I had abandoned ship. Mm-hmm. And how is it that I can start living a great life when I know that my husband, who's now ex-husband, but wasn't doing good, you know, because I had carried him for 10 years. He couldn't work. I just was always there to rescue, and I was certainly not there to rescue anymore. So there was a lot of guilt, and I was glad to not have a phone. For 6 months, I didn't have a telephone, because if I did, I probably would have called and, you know, worked myself into a froth and done something really stupid. So it was those things. A lot of legalistic thinking. One of my biggest things was horrible negative self-talk. I mean, I would say things to me that I would never say to another human being. And I was constantly doing it. So huge obstacles. I can remember you saying, man, Deb, every time you talk about yourself, it's just so bad. You're so hard on yourself. And I was. Mm-hmm. I didn't know how to be any other way. Huge obstacle. So just relearning how to be a human being that is loving and nurturing to themselves. Huge, hard thing for me. And slowing down was probably the key to all of it. If I couldn't slow down and let God do his work and get out of my way, I would be back in my mess.
Slowing down.
Slowing down.
Slowing down. That is just enormous. I really appreciate that. Okay, so from my understanding, you know, I'm always talking to you about where you're at, what you're saying. My sister is just a studying monster, you know. But when she came to our house, it was like 20 below or whatever it was outside. We had a power outage, and she's going through heroin withdrawals on our couch, no power. And she's shaking. I'm like, how you doing? She's like, I'm shaking. I'm like, well, the power's out. We're all shaking. You know, we're all walking around the house same way. She was shaking a little harder, though, I gotta admit. But there she is at our little kitchen table studying Hebrew and translating Bible Hebrew and the grace of God and how God loved her and what God thought of her and all these gems that she would mine out of the scriptures in the Hebrew language, which just amazed me, because anytime I was withdrawn from a heavy narcotic, the last thing I was doing was studying Hebrew. the last thing. Last. It is my understanding that you've been doing a lot of studying in the area of emotions.
Oh, yes.
And I think when it comes to our feelings, that is an enormous part of recovery. Give me some of the revelations. Like, come on, download on us some things. Give us a few tools with our emotions here.
Okay. Emotions, I've always said, I'm such a mystery to myself. I could not understand what in the world was up with me. a lot of that was confusion over emotions. Being in a dysfunctional family where we weren't allowed to express our emotions because we weren't important, it was dad, you know, and all the stuff he was going through. So we just kept our mouth shut. And for me, I would stuff my emotions, just stuff them and stuff them. And I can remember 15 years ago, I saw this chart on someone's wall and it had all these faces on it, you know, and all these different emotions. And I just stood there like I discovered gold. And I asked if I could have a copy of it because I thought surely this will be the map to help me. And emotions have still been kind of a struggle for me. But in the last couple years, I have noticed since being here that I am so out of touch with anger. And it started me on a quest of looking at emotions and the part that it plays in our life. I understand that God has created us in His image. And He has made us so wonderfully. And part of that is emotions. It's a tool for us to navigate through life, to feel, to be a human being. And that's exciting. I've also, and maybe a lot of you can relate to this, I've always thought of emotions as, well, you've got good emotions and you've got bad emotions. Well, I only want to feel the good emotions, you know, the happy, content, you know, all the wonderful things. But all these bad ones, the angry and sorrow and all that, those were negative emotions and I didn't want anything to do with them. Well, I've come to understand that there's really no such thing as good and bad emotions. It is proper emotions. I saw a person just not too long ago who had suffered the loss of a loved one within that week. And while talking about this loss, this person laughed and laughed and laughed. And it was almost creepy. Yeah. It was an improper emotional response to the loss that he was suffering. He just couldn't seem to get in touch with his sorrow, which was sad. Mm-hmm. So as I started studying emotions, I found some really cool tools, okay? And anger, since anger was like a big one for me, anger, if we can look at anger, healthy, flowing anger, if we could look at it as a person, kind of like, I don't know, did any of you see Inside Out, the cartoon Inside Out? Really, really cute. Okay, so if you could, that'll help. If you could see anger as a person, you wouldn't see someone standing up here going, ah, you idiot, ah, you know, you wouldn't see that. What you would see as a healthy, flowing anger would be someone who stands at your boundary because they protect. Anger protects the boundary. It's like this warrior that protects the person from injustice, right? So if someone does come up to you and says, ah, you're an idiot, you know, your anger is there to say, did you just say I'm an idiot? It's there to protect your boundary, and it's there to protect your loved one's boundary. It's also there to protect your singleness, your autonomy. You are you. You have the right to protect you, right? You have the right to choose to protect your loved ones, the people that are here in the room. So anger in its healthy, flowing, honorable state is there in a very healthy way. It doesn't have to be explosive. Now, have you ever seen someone, because I can relate to this, have you ever seen someone who takes their anger and then stuffs it and then stuffs it and shoves it and stuffs it and stuffs it? What happens? They explode. Usually, yeah, they explode. Not very honorable. So anger got kind of a bad rap from that. Or like me, who stuffed and stuffed and stuffed, and now I can't even identify what the heck's going on, you know. Mm-hmm. So getting in touch. Oh, so let me say this. Anger brings gifts in its honor, conviction, proper boundaries, protection of self and others. The question, if you were to ask anger, that's a person, if you could ask anger a question, it would be two questions you could ask. What must be protected? What must be restored?
Good.
Yeah. So
that's good.
Oh, and healthy. So healthy for me to hear these things. Another one, this one's gotten a really bad rap, and it's guilt and shame, right? One of the first things to know about guilt and shame is guilt is not actually an emotion. Guilt is a state. You're either guilty because you took the cookie out of the cookie jar, or you're not guilty because you didn't take the cookie, right? So guilt is a state. Shame is the emotion. Now, healthy, honorable shame, which we're totally not used to hearing, right? A healthy shame would be a warrior that guards the inside boundary of a person. It's like, oh, you don't want to go over there and call that person an idiot because that would be intruding on their boundary. That would be improper behavior. You might bring shame to yourself or to your family. It's an inward warrior. Does that make sense?
Mm-hmm.
Okay, so the question that you might ask this feeling, if you feel it come up, is, has someone been hurt? Or what must be made right? There's a lot of this emotion that we deal with, especially when we're new in recovery.
So you're saying basically that, let me get this right, there's not going to be a quiz, right?
Yes. No. No.
Anger protects kind of me from them in a sense, and mm-hmm. shame protects them from me.
Right. Well, imagine if a person was angry.
I just thought of that.
Imagine if you operated like this is how you operate, is out of anger, and you had no shame. You had no shame. That is a dangerous person.
Right.
A person who operates with no shame has no inner check. They have nothing checking them. And that is a dangerous person. So a healthy operating shame is very important to a person's life. It helps them to mature and to be compassionate. Okay, this one you're probably going to like a lot. The emotion fear. Now, I know that it's really popular to have bumper stickers on your cars that say, no fear. You know, and you watch YouTube and you're seeing all these crazy people jumping off of cliffs with the parachutes and they're just, yee-haw, and doing insane things. So this no fear thing has been really kind of rampant in our world. Well, fear is actually a very healthy emotion to have. And if you could see that as a person, it would be Jackie Chan. Okay? So I like Jackie Chan. He's pretty cool. What happens with a healthy fear, as a matter of fact, you could do an exercise where you could actually feel a healthy fear, okay? So if you want to try it, I'm hoping you're going to try it, but if you want to try it from where you're sitting, what you would do to feel healthy, honorable fear is to sit on the edge of your seat, control your breathing, and then tune your ears to hear as much as you can from all the walls in the room. Look around the room with your eyes as sharp as you can and just take in everything that you can. This alert sense that you're probably feeling, those of you that are doing this, because there is a sense that comes over you when you do this, that's healthy fear. I got to go on a road trip and I came across a whole herd. Do you call herd of caribou? Is that the right word? Saw a whole herd of caribou, and I'm like, oh, I want to take a picture. So I'm running out, and I'm sneaking up on the caribou, right? And they're kind of way out there. But as soon as my head comes up over this hill, I saw 19 caribou all standing there, like, looking at me. And they're ready to run. You know, their ears are perked up, and they were very alert of my presence. They were operating in healthy, appropriate fear. That's why they were still alive.
That's awesome.
Isn't that awesome?
Yeah.
So a healthy fear is like Jackie Chan. They assess and they act however they need to act to survive, to keep safe, to keep their loved ones safe. Fear is an awesome thing. Now, I did see some ptarmigan, those little white fluffy birds. They had no fear, and it was very sad because they're all over the road.
Oh, my
God. I mean, they
word.
Were really all over the road. So fear... So fear, if you could see fear as a person, old Jackie Chan standing there, his gift to you would be intuition, focus, clarity, attentiveness, readiness, and vigor, which I think is awesome. The question you would ask fear is what action should be taken, right? So I think fear is an awesome thing now that I know the, you know, honorable fear. Do I have time to do one more?
Sure.
Okay, sadness. Sadness is a big one. I think most of us in this room can relate to that. Sadness. If you could see sadness as a person, it's the great water bearer of the soul. So if you picture a person with a big staff across their shoulders and buckets of water at either end of that staff, sadness is the water bearer of the soul. It's easy to think that because our tears cleanse our tear ducts, our sinuses, our heads, you know, just, it helps us to release maybe an idea that doesn't work, a relationship that doesn't work. Mm-hmm. Maybe there was a loss of a job. But sadness in its healthy state, its free-flowing, honorable state, is to allow us to just release it, to let go, so that we can make room for the right things for our life. So, what must be released and what must be rejuvenated? Sadness helps us to slow down, to feel our losses, and to release what needs to be released. I don't know if you've ever been so sad at such a great loss that as you really decide to allow that emotion to come up, anger can often step up too and partner with sadness. And it's important too, because to have real sadness, to really go into that emotion, you need a safe place. And so to have a safe place, your boundary has to be protected. Anger can come in and cocoon you. It pushes people away so that you can have your sacred place to release whatever it is. And usually it's a loss of a person when you find this space. It's a very powerful place. For me, I remember feeling my face on fire and my chest was on fire. It was like I was in this capsule of a sacred, sad place that once I was out of it, I could breathe again and I could recover. I wasn't stuck there. When I allow any emotion to flow correctly, to flow in a healthy way, I found that I wasn't stuck in any one emotion. So I am learning.
Good stuff.
I'm learning.
That's really good stuff. All right. So really quick here. I know you do a lot of work with people in recovery. You spend a lot of time. You go through the Genesis material quite a bit with people. You do groups, and you've worked with me and helped me with others. What are some of the keys, both negative and positive, that you see kind of repeating themselves? Things that people kind of keep doing that are keys that keep them locked in their addiction and their problems. And what are some of the keys you see people that get out and break free that you kind of see as a theme? Over and over.
Slowing down. That's like the number one thing. If a person cannot slow down,
there it is again, right?
They're just going to run right into trouble again. So slowing down is like a huge factor. That's the only place where you can hear God is when you slow down. When you're running frantic, it's just almost impossible to.
Good question.
For me, it was instead of running out the door to go be busy, to sit long enough and to journal. Journaling was a big one because you have to slow down to write. You know, you can sit on a couch and watch television and you're not slowing down because television keeps your
That's
head going.
That's really awesome. That's a good point.
You know, so really, and as much as I studied, the quiet time of slowing down was a huge thing for me. As a matter of fact, I'm glad you asked that because going into the journaling, I also was given a really key thing that helped me so much, and that was to pray and say, God, right now I've got this pen in my hand, a blank paper in front of me, and I need to hear from you. Would you just write me a letter? Tell me what you want me to know right now. This is a sacred piece of paper. This is a sacred pen, and I need you to talk to me. Please write me a letter. And then just whatever came to my mind, I would write it out. These letters from God were such a key factor in me being able to slow down. Because when I'd be sitting there panicked out of my mind, I'd pull out one of my God letters and read it. And they were such a comfort to me.
That's really good. And thanks for that question. You know, to me too is my wife's been gone for a few days. I know as I go over my days, you know, I'm getting to spend more time with him and get some real solitude. One of the things I like to do is I light a couple candles, put on some music, you know, really, really calm music, and I just begin to converse very, very quietly and calmly with the Lord. And I actually pull up a chair and, you know, I'm a weird guy when it comes to my devotions, but I mean, I'll talk to him like, is there anything today where you were trying to get my attention and I just blew you off, or I missed it, and you were trying to tell me something and I just overrode and I'll sit real quiet and I'll just spend time with that question. Mm-hmm. Is there a time that you try to get my attention today and I got it? And I cued in and we connected. Like, did that happen between us today? You know, how was I today in these situations? I'll go over my day.
Yeah.
And I'll talk about specific people with the Lord. You know, this person interested in getting them involved in this or walking alongside in this. You know, is this something you want me to do? Is my motives right? Is this flesh coming out of me? You know, and I just really spend time talking to him. And I get really quiet. For me, my pattern's been I do really well, and then right the day before I cross the line, I'll crash and do something stupid, you know, and kind of ruin the whole time. And so last night, I'm trying to go to sleep, and I'm all anxious, and, you know, this is it. If you want to get into something, you know, now's the time to make a break. And I'm laying there trying to go to sleep. My heart's starting to race, and I'm starting to do the faster scale thing. And so I'm like, okay, Lord, when you were on this planet Earth, you slept out under the beautiful sky. What was your heart attitude when you went to sleep? You know, how did you sleep in this world? Where were you at in your head and in your heart when you would sleep under the beautiful gaze of your Father? And I just really got in that. And I got in that place. And then I woke up to this, you know, this morning. So that was a different place all of a sudden. It was being still and giving God time to speak into my life in that way. And I feel like, to me, that's living in the Spirit.
Yeah.
That's praying in the Spirit. And for me, it's a very private but very powerful place in my life.
Yes.
Where I spend time with him that way in images, in my mm-hmm. visual, and in my subconscious, my heart. And that actually comes out with great joy and wonderful fruit of peace and power. Okay, so really quick. Speak to, if you were to walk in here, the Debbie that was here 2.5 years ago was sitting here just arriving off the plane, luggage or whatever you had in hand, and she stood right here in front of you, that girl, what would you say to her right now?
You know, Joe McBride said it to me, and I would have to repeat what she said to me when I came in the doors. It's like, God is pleased with you. God is pleased with you.
Yeah.
Trust him.
So, what of the future? You know, you had a rock in 2.5 years. Like, if you keep going at this rate, you're going to be on Mars. I mean, you're just going off. You're doing amazing things. It's so impressive. It's so encouraging. Where are you going to be 2.5 years, 3 years from now? Like, where's your heart? And I know we don't know, but what do you want to do? Where do you want to be?
I want to continue training in the field of recovery, and it's so huge. It's huge. I've already had wonderful opportunities to go to the RADAC classes down in Anchorage and countless lectures and under professional care and rubbing elbows with geniuses in the recovery field. I want to continue in that education. I want to see it free for everyone. I mean, the hope that this community has given to me. God has used everyone here to give me hope. How can I not want to do that for others? I mean, it's so cool to be in group and going over the Genesis change material, going over the 12 steps,
right?
And just talking out of our heart. Holy smokes, it's just so cool. I just want to do more of that. And that's what I hope God would have for me. I want to see the kingdom grow like huge.
That's wonderful. So does anybody else here have any questions for her? You know, we've laid out the background. We've heard some basic questions here. Anybody have any other questions about what she's experienced these last 2.5 years of just a remarkable recovery, remarkable story? When did you know you made it?
When did I know I'm not going back? Gosh, that's a daily decision and a daily awareness, and it's very humbling. And personally, because of who I am, I have to be careful with a statement like I'm never going back, because part of my addiction, part of my problem, my mental health problems, was that I felt I could do anything in my own strength, and I had such confidence in my flesh. And the more confidence that I would exercise in my flesh, the worse I would do. And so I'd say, by God's grace, this is amazing. And I stand here in victory. I sit here in victory, you know, by God's amazing grace. So I don't know if that answered the question. God's got me, you know, and I rest in that. I totally rest in
that. That's wonderful, yes.
Awesome question.
That's a good question.
Awesome question. Well, in the Genesis Change material, they've got a thing called the Faster Scale, and it tells on you. When you go through this list, like, this is what I look like in recovery, you know, and then it starts going, okay, and this is when I start looking like when I get squirrely, and then squirrelier and squirrelier until I'm squirreled, you know? Uh-huh. And so
at some point, you got to let go of the squirrel part.
And being able to go through that list with a sober mind and with a group that cares deeply for you, going through that in a sober-minded way, when you start getting squirrely, and the further down this faster scale that's written out, and I'm sure we could get a copy for you if you'd like to see it, but the further you go down on the scale, the more you go into what they call the limbic system. That's your survival part of your brain. And the further you get into that part of your brain, you don't even see it. Your blind spot. The further you get down, the more blind you are, you know. And so that's where it's so important to have a group.
Right. And that has to do with survival.
Oh, man.
So, right. Every addict believes that if they quit or give it up, something bad's going to happen to them. And once they go to that level and panic, you know, it's game over. So that's a big part of her key was slowing down. That's a big part of staying out of that.
Yeah. You know, I didn't have the self-confidence to do it. What I did have was I knew that Jesus loved me enough that he made it worthwhile for me to get back up. You know, I don't know if you want to say more to that, but just knowing that God loves me and he's not giving up on me, you know, and because he's not giving up on me, he has surrounded me with people that aren't giving up on me. And the bigger that positive support gets, the easier it is to stay there. But that doesn't mean that you don't have bad squirrely days, you know.
That's one. And, you know, we were at this, I don't know how long we were doing the underground. I was a recovery pastor, however long it was. I'm not exactly sure, but we were well established as people that were doing this recovery thing. And I had a buddy call me in the middle of the night, and he was in the middle of a big meth binge. And he was a good friend of mine. So I was like, I'm not going to tell anybody. I'm not going to call my sponsor over here. I'm not going to call anybody. I'm just going to go over there and help him. And, I'm the recovery guy. I'm the underground guy. Put my cape on. I got it, right? Mm. You can see what's coming, right?
Secrets.
And I get over there, and, you know, I leave with stuff on me in my pockets, and I'm helping him, right, clearing his house out. And on my way home, I'm like, hey, I'm loaded. I got all – nobody knows. And by the time I got home, you know, schemer going on, I was in active relapse. I relapsed. That one night I fell, and my wife gets on the phone, and our house was full of underground people by that night. Talk about a horrible night. And I'm sitting there in the living room with a hoodie over me, shaking like a leaf. And what do you do? And I'm like, if I can't tell my recovery group what just happened to me, then I have utterly failed in establishing the grace of God or anything about what we're trying to do. And we got back up, and I said, I'm going to stand up and begin again, guys. Who wants to stand with me? And the whole place stood up, and we white-chipped a new beginning.
And it was awesome.
And it's been an amazing journey. I learned a ton from that.
Yeah.
And so I'm under the management of God, and I'm to listen to him. And if I ask him first, do you want me to go here? Do you want me to do this? Do you want me to talk to this person? Do you want me to stay put? You know, my job is to submit to him and stay under his care. And then he does the heavy lifting and he does the rest. I don't stick myself out there anymore because it's his strength. He's the lion. He's the one that's bad to the bone.
That's right.
I hide in him and let him do the rest. And I want to stay in that place.
Oh.
And so when I came out flexing, thinking I was something, you know, I got chewed up like a little chihuahua, you know. And it was pretty ugly. People got hurt, you know. And so thank you for asking that question.
Awesome question.
You wheel up, you surround yourself with people that believe and know the grace of God, and they admit their failings and weaknesses as well. And they're behind you winning, not, you know, overshadowing you and waiting to squash you, you know. So anybody else have any more comments or questions about? Yeah, Don.
Repeat the question.
Greatest fear of getting off the plane. How'd you get past that?
Acceptance. I was humiliated getting off that plane, scared, but feeling like an utter failure in every respect. So in my mind, I had already chewed myself and judged myself to oblivion, you know. So getting off that plane was horrifying. What fixed that was Glenna's hug as soon as I got off the plane. And she said, "We've got you." Yeah.
So awesome.
But it took months when I would come to Underground and people would hug me, I would bawl. It's not like I would just tear, you know.
Yeah.
But people would hug me, and that kind of acceptance and love tore down walls that they will never, never know. And it took months of just bawling. Every time somebody would hug me, I'm like, "Oh, great, here, I'm going to cry again." You know, but they would hug me, and it was just so cleansing, and it was just tearing down walls and tearing down walls. And it was very important. Love. Love is it.
Yeah.
Pray. You know, praying, because once a person, depending on how far down the faster scale they've gone, how squirrely they've become, they might not even hear. Mm-hmm. It's when they're in their sober time, identifying the false beliefs, you know, because there are false beliefs that trigger everything.
Yep.
And addiction is about safety. It's that survivor part of our limbic system. And so if we're starting to get triggered and starting to get squirrely, it's because there are things being triggered in a pretty bad way. Yeah.
One of the hardest lessons for me is to learn that I can't drive the car in front of me, and I can drive my car. And if I rein them in through my power and strength, then I'm going to have to keep them in through my power and strength. And I can't possibly sign up for that. Some people may believe some other things here, but I know that God has a stance towards me, which is open arms, sometimes in great sadness and sorrow as I go and learn some things. Maybe I need some more street therapy. And it's hard. And there are people that I don't chase people down. I don't rub their noses in it. I believe in them. I see it in them. When they're ready to try again, then I always believe this is the time it's going to work.
This is it.
And it really, really is. And I do believe in that, but I don't try to grasp onto anybody because they automatically then pull away. And that's a very difficult thing to do.
Very.
So, any other comments or questions? I guess I just want to close this session out by saying, you know, as a person that I lived as an addict almost my entire life, very heavy needle user, crack addict, meth addict, and all those terrible things. The most profound thing that I think that I have learned in a nutshell is that God really, really is who he says he is. He really, really is who he says he is. And guess what? The crazy part comes after that. You really are who he says you are.
Oh.
You really, really are.
Yeah.
And when I get that, I get everything.
That's right.
And we become people that can love others. And that's pretty awesome.
Oh, that's
you guys
want to
give my sister a hand?
Yeah.
Cool. Oh.
Pierces through in the darkest hidden place. It knows your deepest secrets, but it never looks away. It's the gentle hand that pulls you from the judgment of the crowd. When you stand before them guilty, every that Jesus took my place. Just call it what it is. Just call it what it is. Oh, just call it what it is. Call it grace. A better word than all the empty claims I've heard upon this earth speaks righteousness for me and stands in my defense. Jesus is your blood. Your blood speaks a better word. All the empty claims I've heard upon this earth speaks righteousness for me and stands in my defense. Jesus is your blood. What can wash away our sins? Whole again, oh, nothing but your blood, nothing but the blood of Jesus. What can wash us pure as snow? Welcome as the friends of God. Nothing. Testifies in grace, tells of the Father's heart to make a way for us. Now boldly we approach, not earthly confidence, it's only by your blood. Thank you.